Her research includes a lot on scholarly publishing issues, information behavior, and interdisciplinary research methods. She's currently doing a lot of research for faculty perception of open access, so keep an eye out for those publications. In her past life, she was the marketing communications manager for Jansport and also the project manager of project management, a lot of managing, for a digital imaging company that worked with a lot of really big corporate clients. So not only is she a librarian, but she also has a lot of marketing and project management experience. Kind of makes you like a triple threat. So please welcome Jen Waller.
I'm going to see what happens if I just kind of set this down and don't wear it. If you can't hear me, please raise your hand and I'll either put it on or talk louder or something. So my name is Jen Waller and I am unaffectionately known as a glass bowl. thank you for inviting me, and thank you all for attending this. I'm going to talk about Google Glass. I'm going to talk a little bit about how it works and kind of my perceptions of how it works and what I think about it. And I'm also going to talk about how I'm using it to teach students about privacy. So in July, I got a notification that I had been chosen, one of about 8,000 people in the United States, to be what Google is calling a Glass Explorer. And this gives, Glass Explorers have the opportunity to use and to beta test Google's newest consumer technology called Glass, which is essentially a head-mounted mobile phone, if you will. So I've always been interested in how people perceive technology, especially new technology, and I'm very interested in library services and education methods using new technology, especially the library services part. So I jumped at the chance to be involved in this program. People asked me about how I was selected, and I've been really sheepish about how I was selected. And I've decided the last, actually, couple of days to kind of come clean about this. Last winter, Google asked people to tweet or to upload videos to YouTube, ways that they would use Glass if they had Glass, and then to use the hashtag if I had Glass. And the explorers, Glass Explorers, would be chosen from this pool of people who had tweeted if I had Glass. I need to pause right here. I'm getting over a cold, so I'm very sorry if I'm sniffling or if I have to cough or something like that. I apologize. So I was certainly aware that Google was working on what we were then calling Google Glasses. I was definitely aware of the technology. I wasn't really aware of the context or the drawing, though. But then I started seeing tweets from colleagues about that had this hashtag, if I had Glass. So this is one of the tweets that I saw, and it's from Glenn Platt, who I'll talk about a little bit later. But he really kind of summed up my feelings about what I would do with Glass if I had Glass. And it says, my students and I would show that learning is everywhere, which I feel is really important. We would help lead our university to redefine experiential higher ed. So really not knowing much anything about this context, I retweeted Glenn Platt. I couldn't even retweet him. It wouldn't all fit into 140 characters. So I did a modified tweet, which means that yeah, I modified it. I removed some words. I changed it a little bit. I didn't even do a good modified tweet. You'll notice that there's a space right here. I left out a word. And so that's really the embarrassing part of my story, that I got chosen to be a Glass Explorer based on the tweet of another person, which, as a librarian, I've had some really tough nights thinking about, is this plagiarism? But the other side of the story is that Google should be choosing librarians to be Glass Explorers. We work every single day to connect people with information. And Google Glass is really an information delivery tool. On a more personal note, I've been a very early supporter and user of Google products. I was using Google Mail when it also required an invitation, and I don't know if you remember that, but it was very difficult. I mean, people were really clamoring to get Gmail invitations, which is kind of ludicrous now. And I used Calendar and Google Calendar and Maps and all of their products since they were released. And I provide feedback informally just through the normal Google channels. And I also, so I kind of support them. I also speak out when I don't agree or don't like something that they're doing. I'm active on social media and social networks, and I have a pretty wide, diverse set of friends and social media contacts. Plus, I'm a librarian. So I think that Google's selection process wasn't entirely random. I think that there was a reason that even though I retweeted Glenn, I think that there's a reason that I was kind of chosen over him. He won't want to hear that, however. So Google required that Glass Explorers pay $1,500 for the device. And luckily, my dean covered that out of a library innovation grant fund. They also required that all explorers travel to either New York, Los Angeles, or San Francisco to pick up their glass. And luckily, my dean covered that cost as well. I think that Google was really smart about doing this. This is a brand new form factor. And it required some training, in a sense. So explorers, I went to New York, explorers in general, spent between 45 minutes and 2.5 hours with what they called a glass guide. And this was an individual instruction session where you chose the color of the glass that you wanted. The guide fit it to you and adjusted it and made sure that it all worked on your face, and then showed you how to use it, and then answered questions, any questions that you had. So, like I said, for some people, this took over 2 hours. This is a terrible photo from kind of a composition point of view, but you can tell some interesting things about it. This is the very first photo that I took using Google Glass. And the first thing that you can tell about it is, maybe you can tell about it, is that while the composition is terrible, the quality of the photo isn't awful. And Google Glass, I should say, can take some decent photos and videos. The second thing that you might notice is that the glass appointments took place in this empty warehouse kind of loft space in over the Chelsea Market in Lower Manhattan. And this was across the street from Google's New York headquarters. And what I imagined was an empty loft space. And so there's a lot of, all of the furniture in here was very flexible, movable. They could rearrange things, set things up very quickly on the fly. And this really reminded me, interestingly, of how libraries operate with flexible furniture. You can kind of see down at the bottom here, there's a My Glass, called My Glass website, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. But there is a website that I can log into. It's my own personal kind of dashboard. And lastly, I haven't shared this with many people because frankly, I don't know if they care, but I think I'll share it with you because some of you might care and or appreciate this. You can see that there's a pretty tall person in the background there. So Rory Hibbert is a player for the Indiana Pacers. I can see some of you shaking your head yes, who know who he is. And he tweeted, this is him getting his picture taken, and you can see him in my picture, you can see him in the background. he was getting his class fitted at the same time I was, which was kind of exciting. Very off topic for here, but I thought that some of you might appreciate it. So one of Google's inspirations for glass is this kind of behavior. It's this thing that we see everywhere. All these people with their heads buried in their cell phone. And I see this a lot on campus. I imagine that you do too. People texting, searching, looking for directions, using Twitter, quickly checking email, but all with their head down. And I think Google really got it right in this regard. You have to have your head down because you have to hold this. And Google wanted to create something that was hands-free. And I think that, like I said, Google really got it right. I think that hands-free is going to become increasingly important in the future. Think about kind of how many times you reach in your pocket, your back pocket, in your purse, to grab your cell phone, or having to juggle it when you're trying to open a door or get someplace. Google identified this, I think, as a usability issue, and they are actively working to solve it. In fact, one of my colleagues' biggest reasons for wanting glass had to do with exactly this hands-free aspect. He has a young daughter. This is not her. But he wanted to be able to push his daughter in a swing, and at the same time, shoot a video, or even better, call his mom, or do a video chat with his mom, or a Google Hangout with his mom while wearing glass, and so that his mom could see her granddaughter, could see her, could hear her laughing, could see her smiling. And this is possible now with a cell phone, but it's not exactly easy because it's not hands-free. So this brings up kind of another aside that I want to mention, and because I'm interested in how people perceive new technology, I think it's really important for us to keep in mind some of these kind of human aspects about new technology. A lot of times we have really knee-jerk reactions about it, but there's often kind of a human side that will bring us closer up. And I just think that's really important for us to think about when we evaluate and use new technology. So I never thought of myself as, certainly I'm not a futurist. I don't really think of myself as a technologist other than the things that I just use every day. And I don't even think of myself as an early adopter. I think of myself as kind of a mid-adopter, kind of. But regardless, I did immediately see a whole range of uses for glass in the work that I do at Miami, and one of those was teaching students about privacy. So a little background or context before I start talking about the classes, I want to just give you a little bit of background about Miami. It was established in 1809. It's a public university. Its main campus is in Oxford, Ohio. It has three smaller regional campuses, one in Hamilton, one in Middletown, and one in Westchester, Ohio. In 2012, the total full-time enrollment was 21,000 undergraduate students and 3,700 graduate students. The university focuses primarily on undergraduate liberal education. They offer bachelor's degrees in over 100 areas, master's degrees in about 50 areas, and several doctoral programs. And the other thing that you can tell is there's lots and lots of red brick. So one of the programs at Miami is called AIMS. This is the Armstrong Institute for Interactive Media Studies. And AIMS is an interdisciplinary program that examines how digital technology is transforming traditional areas of inquiry. So I'm an affiliate instructor in AIMS. That means I teach a class called IMS 201, which is Information in the Digital Age. IMS 201 is a semester-long course. It's for undergrads, and it explores what it means to be information literate in today's world. It includes all aspects of the information lifecycle. And that also includes some of the ethical and legal issues. So it's a foundation course for an IMS minor. It's a requirement for an IMS major. And the person who I retweeted, Len Platt, is the director of AIMS. So when I teach IMS classes, he is my boss, and he's actually my boss's boss. So entirely unrelated to the fact that he wanted glass and I got it instead, and that he's my boss, or my boss's boss, I was not scheduled to teach any IMS classes this academic year. And that turned out to be a really good thing. Not having this course overload gave me time to schedule visits with each of the IMS instructors, each of the IMS 201 instructors, I should say, and to talk about class and privacy. So depending on the class, whether it was 3 days a week, once a week, class sessions were 55 minutes to 2 hours, 30 minutes. So at the outset, I want to say that GLASS is still the carrot or the hook that gets students interested in this discussion about privacy and about this class session. Because kind of the makeup of the IMS 201 classes, these students are interested in technology anyway. They were very interested to learn how I acquired GLASS, to learn how it works, to try it out for themselves, and also to pick up some creative uses for it in the future. So if GLASS was the carrot, hopefully these privacy discussions weren't the stick. I don't think they were, because there was always, in every class, lots of participation, lots of interaction, and lots of discussion about issues that, frankly, I think some of them had never thought about before. So one of the most reported privacy concerns about GLASS had to do with people taking photos without other people's knowledge or consent. And this is not so far as some places, I know of a place in Seattle, has banned GLASS. You're not allowed to wear GLASS in this establishment. But I really wanted students to think critically about this stance. This mirrors a lot of the kind of what if and kind of oh no, the sky is falling reaction that a lot of people have with new technology. I wanted students to understand that GLASS isn't really the issue here. Certainly, people can take photos of you without your knowledge, without your consent, on a cell phone, currently, when you're in a public place. But that's still about technology, kind of even worse, I would say. Doesn't really have to do with technology at all. People can take photos of you with a telephoto lens, and they have been able to for years and years and years, when you're in a private place. So anybody, any celebrity who's been shot by paparazzi can tell you this. So this fear about photography, I believe, really isn't related to GLASS. It's related, I think, to three other things that all have to do with the web. And the first one, is instantaneous dissemination. So in the past, we have to be really careful about the number of photos that we took. And we would didn't want to waste film. We carefully compose our photographs. We take 12 or 24 or 36 photographs at a time. We unload them from the camera. We take them to the film to be processed, the prints to be developed. And this could take 24 hours, but it longer though, it could take a week, much longer. If we wanted copies made, we could get copies made when the prints were being processed or developed, and we could disseminate those by mailing them to friends. So we could make photocopies. Quality was not as good. Still had to mail them. So a lot of this just wasn't cost effective. It just wasn't fast, much less an instantaneous. So obviously the web changed all that. The second thing that I think people fear about privacy and photography is really about the persistence of online data. And once a photo is uploaded to the web, it's there to stay. There's no delete button. And this greatly surprised students. They thought that they could delete something when it got deleted from their monitor, their phone, that it was gone.
Seriously?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Yeah. So this became clear to me in comments that I would get from end of class evaluations. And it really drove this point home. Students have been taught about privacy in terms of not uploading compromising photos of themselves, like to Facebook or to Twitter, even though they do it anyway. That they know about, that they've been taught since they were in fourth grade. But not understanding the complexities and that the data is persistent really spoke to that they didn't understand the way that the web works. Kind of beyond, oh my gosh, my future employer might see this photo, or my mother might see this photo. So talking about persistence of data allowed me to show them, talk about this, talk about how the web works, and also show them things like Internet Archive and the Wayback Machine, to talk about how the Library of Congress is archiving tweets. And then the last thing, or the third thing, I shouldn't say the last, but the third thing kind of surrounding the sphere of photography and privacy, I think has to do with the ease of search. And finding people and things now is super easy. It's much easier to find photos of people now. And I would suggest that if you were just a regular person, which I think we pretty much all are, you couldn't even really talk about finding photos of us before the web. It just didn't happen. You might find a photo on the ground. It might have somebody's name on the back. But you just, the findability just wasn't there. Excuse me. So another set of issues that I would talk about kind of had to do with my objections to glass. And one of these objections revolves around the platforms. I don't like putting all of my eggs in one basket. I tend to scatter my online and computing environment. I spread my digital footprint around. So I don't use Facebook or Instagram at all. I use Twitter, I use Flickr, I use Mac and I use Windows. I use Chrome, I use Safari, I use Firefox. And this is just a personal preference. I don't want to put all of my eggs in Google's basket. But not surprisingly, Google wants you to do that. And there are some privacy implications to that. So we would discuss some of the privacy implications as it related to a reliance on Google for so many things. And we would also talk about things like Google Books. And that would kind of lead into discussions about who is able to view what you're reading. This brings up some much, much bigger issues. And certainly this became very much in the headlines, pretty much as soon as I picked up my glass, or kind of right before. I deliberately didn't delve deeply into the issues that the world is having with NSA or with Edward Snowden's revelations about the NSA. We would talk briefly a little bit about Edward Snowden, about the NSA, about the Guardian articles, but quite frankly, it was just kind of beyond my capacity to keep up with the level of detail and how quickly the news was changing in a way to be able to really feel like they could answer their questions in a meaningful way. So, but like I said, Google wants you to put all your glass eggs in one basket, And so we did talk about how Google prioritizes their tools and services over all others. So first, Google requires that if you have Glass, or I should say Glass requires, that you have a Google Plus account. So this is a requirement. I already had one, so this was not a big deal to me. I actually really like Google Plus. But more importantly, and this is huge, Glass automatically uploads your photos and videos to your Google Plus account. Automatically. You are not required to share them. You're not required to make them public. And you can't delete them. But the delete button, if you will, is hidden behind a menu, so they don't make it obvious or simple to delete them. But most importantly, you're not given the choice of where to upload these photos. And like I said, I upload my photos to Flickr. So in order to do that, I have to, if I take them through Glass, I don't upload them. They automatically go to my Google Plus account. I can then download them and move them to Flickr. And then I can delete them if I choose. So the implications of this became much more clear to students when they had the opportunity to try on Glass for themselves. The right side of Glass over here is a touchpad. And so you can swipe forward to kind of scroll the screen forward. You swipe backwards to scroll it the other way. You swipe down to go to the previous screen, or in most cases, to go to kind of home, the welcome screen, Glass's welcome screen. But most importantly, you tap it to select something. And it's really easy to mix up these gestures when you first try on Glass. It's not necessarily intuitive. Like I said, this is a new form factor. This isn't really something that we've done. And even though this is a touchpad and we've all worked with the touchpads on our laptops, this is a little different. You can't really see what you're doing. And there's an odd kind of muscle memory, I think, that makes us want to tap it, which selects it and shares it. So therefore, it's really easy, especially using it for the first time, or if you're a student using it for the first time, to take a picture or to select something and then not really know what to do. So you tap it, which selects it. You can't really tell what happened. You tap it again, and now it's shared. So Glass is tied to my personal Gmail and my personal Google account. It's not tied to my university account. So again, this really kind of hit home. Glass does have a guest mode that you can put it in, and I would always do that. This is a good way to talk about kind of what the technology is. And when you say, would you ever loan your unlocked cell phone, just give it to somebody and let them scroll through your, I should say smartphone, scroll through your email contacts and scroll through your emails and your tweets. That's kind of what letting somebody use Glass is like. So Google is working with developers to create apps, more and more kind of coming online each week. And every time you recharge the Glass device, it gets refreshed with new, not always new apps, but an upgrade, kind of a system upgrade. And so you can choose what products and services to interact with via Glass. So there's the ones that you would expect, Gmail, Google Plus, of course. There's Facebook, there's Twitter. You kind of expect those. There are some media apps like CNN Breaking News, Elle Magazine, which seems a little odd to me, the New York Times, and there's some sports media apps to get sports news. One that was just added fairly recently is called Fancy. That's a shopping app. That's another one that's a little difficult for me to understand because I don't need to be hands-free when I shop, but I guess some people do. One place where hands-free might be useful is in the kitchen when you're cooking. So there's a new, and I haven't even tried this, it was just added from the last time, this screenshot is like taken yesterday. This KitchMe app allows you to find recipes and then view them in the screen, that's kind of what sits above your eye, and follow them. It seems like it could be useful. But when you try to add some of these apps to Glass, you get messages like this one. And this is a fantastic way to engage in a conversation about privacy with students. So I have to give kind of a shout out to a recommendation to the Wall Street Journal, and they have a series called What They Know, and I highly recommend it. It's ongoing reports about privacy and security, and they're really well done with graphics and interactive graphics, and it's been going on for years. So there's a lot of good information, especially very easy kind of for students to digest about privacy and security in this What They Know series. But these apps, as we know, collect location information. They collect unique identifiers for your phone, kind of like a serial number for your phone. They can collect personal data, like your sex and your age. And then, again, as we know, they routinely send this information to marketing agencies who compile profiles on phone users. Students were vaguely aware that this happened when they're online, just at a desktop computer and surfing the web. They were aware. They knew about cookies. They knew that they get targeted ads. So they were, I don't think they really thought through it, but they were aware of it. They were actually unaware that this practice exists with mobile apps, and especially Glass, because they hadn't tried Glass. But they were very unaware that this kind of stuff happened with mobile apps. So this led to a discussion about privacy policies, both on websites and on mobile apps and on Glass. And as you can see, only one in two of the most popular Android and iOS apps offer a privacy policy prior to downloading the app. Then only a third offer it within the app once you've already downloaded the app. And you can see that 28% of mobile apps don't have a privacy policy at all. I would venture to guess that 28% is significantly higher with Glass. I don't remember ever seeing a privacy policy except for the one that was for Glass, that Google provides for Glass. So I want to say again that Glass was kind of the hook here. They were already interested in this, and they already are familiar with other technology that has to do with privacy policy. They already know that they ignore privacy policies when they're on websites. And they already know that they ignore privacy policies when they are downloading a mobile app. But so it's difficult to kind of hold on to a smartphone and wave it in front of a class and talk about this, because I think that students just kind of take this for granted. I think we all do to some extent. And certainly, I mean, it's kind of like cars. I think we know that it works. We don't know exactly how it works, but we just know that it works. This is a really good way to discuss how we all trade privacy for convenience. Like I said, students were vaguely aware of terms of service and privacy policies, but I'm going to say we. I'm not going to say they anymore. But we really want the product. We really want the tool. We really want the service. So we knowingly sign up for these services. We provide our information, and even though we're not always aware of how that information is going to be used. So this was a great conversation that I had with students about how we all, how much living online we do. And for a lot of us, we kind of reflect about that, we kind of think about that. For a student who is 19, 20 years old, this is just what they do. They live online. They don't think about this. They don't reflect about it. So this led to conversations about just how much information we knowingly put online. So certainly that included Facebook, status updates, and status updates on Twitter. But it includes information when we sign up for shopping sites, and then when we do product reviews on shopping sites. We are making flight reservations online. Our, like I said, our location is tracked. Increasingly, our home energy usage is going online with products like Nest and with utility companies wanting to kind of be more involved in the conservation and wanting you to helping you to monitor your energy conservation. Our bank statements are online. Increasingly, our medical records are online. As the population ages more and more, we're purchasing prescription drugs online. And we file our taxes online. So this was just a really good way for students to really reflect about how much information we put online. And this is where I'm pretty sure that we don't understand some of the long-term consequences of all of this information about us being out there. Many of us spend time kind of grooming our online personas. Certainly, some of the juniors and seniors in the IMS classes were doing this because they're beginning to look for jobs. And they're aware that employers are going to be taking a look at how they look on these social media sites. So we choose our images, we choose our words to create this portrait of ourselves online, and we want to control our image. But there's a lot going on kind of behind the monitor, behind the scene, behind the screen that we don't really see, that we don't have any control over. And students were really concerned when they thought about this, that this is a persona that they can't control, they can't see it, yet it's being used to make decisions about them, to make judgments about them, and about us. Excuse me. So kind of switching to a slightly different topic, one of the things that Glass has trouble doing is connecting to a closed network. And Glass has some connection problems across the board. So a network that requires you to kind of to sign an agreement and then a unique ID and a password, which is most universities actually, is impossible to connect to. I had to go to our IT department and get an exception, and it never works. So most of the time when I'm on campus, I'm using Glass through an insecure network. It's kind of a guest open network on campus. There's other connection issues as well. I mentioned that Glass wants you to put all your eggs into Google's basket, and this is especially true with how Glass works with Wi-Fi. It's no surprise that it's relatively easy, I'll say very easy, to connect if you have an Android phone. Google has created what's called My Glass. It's an app that if you have an Android phone, you download it to your phone, and when you're in a location that has Wi-Fi, you just connect to the Wi-Fi with your smartphone. The My Glass app then creates a QR code. And you point your glass at the QR code. Glass reads the QR code and joins the network. Very, very smooth, very easy. There's not a My Glass app for iOS, though. And I have an iPhone. So if I want to connect to wireless, but I want my glass to connect to wireless. I can't do it through my phone. I have to do it through my laptop. So the website that you saw in the very first photo that I took with glass, I have to go to that website. Again, similar to what you do in your mobile phone, I join the network, I put on my glass, I'm simplifying things a little bit, point it at the QR code that it's generated, and glass connects to the network. I probably don't need glass. If I've got my laptop with me, I really don't need to be using glass. But to your credit, Google thought about this. And they allow the situation where if you have iOS, because my glass app isn't available for iOS, you can tether, using Bluetooth, you can tether glass to your iPhone. I can't do that, however, and this has really limited my experience with glass. I'm grandfathered in on a data plan. I have unlimited data. So in order for me to tether glass to my phone, I have to change my data plan and limit the amount of data. I have no interest in doing that. So this is kind of all to say that there are lots and lots of connection issues that Google needs to work on. And for right now, much of the data that passes through glass is probably over open Wi-Fi, and it's probably not secure. So discussing this, and sometimes actually going through the struggle, there's often, when I'm going to a classroom, a lot of technical difficulties, a lot of struggling with trying to get it connected. Going through the struggle kind of helped me explain some of these connection issues. But it also allowed me to kind of introduce things like fire sheet, and how if you are at a coffee shop and not using a secure HTTP, then somebody can do something like this. And again, they weren't exactly aware what HTTPS was. They certainly didn't know at all what Miami's VPN was. And so this was a really good opportunity to talk about the VPN, to show them how to connect to it, and especially if they were living off campus, recommend that they use the VPN. And frankly, a lot of these issues kind of scared them a little, and I think this was in combination with understanding how much data is out there about them, and kind of with some of these security issues. I think that they got a little bit scared. But just so you don't think that this is all doom and gloom, and that I was like scaring all these students in the classroom. A lot of my work as a librarian, and as yours too, involves thinking about privacy. But at least as much, and in my case, definitely more, involves thinking about sharing. So one of my primary responsibilities is talking about scholarly communication and open access issues on our campus and promoting open access in our institutional repository and sharing work on our campus. There's many ways that glass is used, and kind of the whole glass experience it's not really about sharing. It's a very personal, kind of a very personal, singular experience. Like I said, just like you don't share your mobile phone. But I really thought that it was important for students to understand and think about the value of sharing, and to understand that it's really important, and that they can gain a lot by contributing to the web instead of just consuming. So certainly in the longer classes that I taught, I would spend a third of the time on privacy, a third of the time about sharing, and a third of the time about just using glass and kind of how to use it and giving them the experience of being able to use it. But the title of this keynote is not teaching about sharing using Google Glass, it's teaching about privacy. So I'm gonna end it here except that this is our time to share. I would love to hear your questions about laughs, about privacy, about anything that you thought about while I was talking, anything that I've talked about. And thank you for listening. Does anyone have any questions? I should say, what are your questions? Yes?
Are there any voice control
Absolutely.
Operations?
Yes, Glass is primarily voice control. The touchpad is there. There's some operations that it's much easier just to tap it or touch it. But yeah, it is absolutely voice control for almost everything.
You address it.
You say okay, Glass. Yeah. You get a when you first turn it on, you get a welcome screen that has the time, and then it has the phrase "Okay, Glass," and you say "Okay, Glass," and then a menu comes up, and there's a number of different things that you can do. And when you're speaking, you have to be very specific. You can say Google, and it will Google something for you. You can say take a picture. You can say shoot a video. You can say, give me directions. I am not able to get this. Really unfortunate, again, for an iPhone user. You can't get directions using an iPhone. And it's probably next semester I will invest in some kind of used Android. I feel like I need to have a richer experience with this. But yeah, menu comes up, then you can search for something. You can search for Miami University. And a lot of times it's taken from a Wikipedia entry, and it will read it to you. It will start reading. You hear it. It has bone conduction technology, and you hear it. You hear it in your ear, but you hear it in a very strange way, kind of right behind your ear. And it starts reading whatever article it found for you.
You don't get your language once it starts
reading? No, but you can scroll through. And so just like you would get a page of Google search results, you get one result, but then if you scroll, you see the next result. You don't. The interface is different from a web page. It's one view at a time. So one of the things about sharing is that I have Glass with me, and if anyone's interested in trying it on, seeing how it works, just getting a sense of kind of what it does, I'm happy to do that. I can't stick around all evening or anything, but maybe after the door prizes are handed out for anybody who's interested, I'm more than happy. I'll see if I can get it connected. I was able to get it connected earlier today, and I will be putting it on guest mode, but you're welcome to try it. Yeah.
Do you have the problems with your glasses, or do you wear it not with them?
No, this is a huge problem. And just on Monday, Google announced that Glass Explorers are going to be able to swap out their glass for kind of a second generation. They're also opening up the program so that Glass Explorers can invite three people. I don't know if those three people automatically get chosen or what, but this is the biggest problem with Glass for me, and it doesn't have to do with privacy, so I didn't suspect it, but you can't wear it with correct lenses. So when I wear Glass, I sometimes have trouble reading what's in the actual glass because it projects, I think it says that it projects, I can't remember the dimensions, but at maybe a certain number of feet, a certain size of a certain number of feet. It's not right up close. I mean, you see it, like it's kind of out there a little bit. On some things, I have a whole lot of trouble. I squint to kind of see the letters. But then also when I'm wearing it, I can't see people in the audience. I can't see somebody across the room because I don't have my glasses on. So the next iteration that's hopefully going to be, I would just expect available maybe, I don't know how long it's going to take for the swap out to happen. The next iteration can supposedly work with glasses, which I'm really looking forward to. And it also, I'm not a big earbud user. I just don't listen to a lot of, I just don't use earbuds a lot. But the next iteration has an earbud as well, and I don't know if that means that kind of the odd sounding bone conduction is going away. But yeah, that is probably the biggest issue with glass.
Glass always
screen always on the right side?
It's always on the right side.
Because I, the way I wear my contacts, which I wouldn't have a problem with glasses.
Right.
And glass.
Right.
But I have one lens for distance, and I have an eye that's better at a distance.
Right.
One lens for close up, and that would...
It's worse.
I'm
sure Google has thought of that. My guess, I've got a couple, like I said, I am not a futurist. I don't know. I especially don't know what Google, I just don't know. But I do know that they are working with optometrists. I know of a couple optometrists too. I don't know them. I know of that they have them. And this, like I said, this is a really, really big issue. I don't see a reason. Again, it's on the right side, this touchpad and the glass. Everything is on the right side. I don't see a reason why you couldn't just have all of it on the left side. I do see a reason why it would be difficult to have the glass on the left side and the touchpad on the right. It all is kind of interconnected. So, yeah, good question. Anyone else? I'm still not used to a lot of it, and I think that there's some things that it's odd, and I never know if this is something that I've missed or if it is something new, but I'll be wearing them and I'll discover something new about them. Like, I mean, it took me the longest time to realize that you could scroll through search results. I did learn that pretty much in the beginning, but it does seem like I don't think I'll get used to them ever. Again, that partly has to do with my vision and, you know, kind of the vision issues. It is, I will say, once you are wearing them, and I thought about wearing them for this presentation, but there's not really a reason to. It's surprising how kind of easy they are. You don't notice this thing unless you want to. I think the most annoying thing is Saturday Night Live had a really funny skit with Fred Armisen and the person who does Weekend Update, Seth Meyer, about glass. And it shuts off very frequently and very quickly. They say that it does that to preserve the battery life. But it's really quick. And the fastest way to get it to come back awake is to bob your head up. So the 7-minute live is Fred Armisen like doing all these crazy popping his head, trying to get it to come back quick alive. It's very funny. So the speed at which it goes off so quickly, that's kind of hard to get used to. Yeah, I think that they'll tweak that and be able to change that, and I think we'll eventually be able to kind of adjust that. So, okay. Yes?
You're not much of a shopper, are you?
I am not a shopper.
Yeah, that I wanted to clear something up for you with the L and other things. Yeah, it's that, oh my God, Jen, look at these shoes.
Oh, you're right.
That's why it's important. Yeah, that's why they're on there, because if you
right.
need to sell something in a moment,
right.
by showing someone else's friend.
That's exactly, and I do not use the web that way. I don't use, you know, I just don't. I'm not a shopper at all. So thank you, I appreciate that. Anyone else? Okay. Well, thank you very much. And like I said, I'll stick around.